Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. When Shavkat Mirziyoyev became Uzbekistan's president in late 2016, he promised the old ways of governing the country were over. Mirziyoyev vowed to implement sweeping reforms, including giving the media much more room to report. He even encouraged journalists to report on issues that needed correcting in society and in government. But there are clearly still limits to what can be said or written in Uzbekistan, and several independent journalists and bloggers have run into trouble. The Uzbek Forum for Human Rights recently released a report entitled, "President's Broken Promises Put Journalists and Bloggers at Risk," that looks at the fate of some of those who crossed unmarked boundaries in disseminating information. To discuss all this, I am joined by Umida Niyazova, director of the Uzbek Forum for Human Rights, which is based in Germany, and Matthew Schaff, rights advocate and advocacy director at the Washington-based organization Freedom Now. And both Umida and Matthew took part in preparing the Uzbek Forum for Human Rights report. Now, thank you both for joining me. And Umida, let's start with you. And let's start with the change of leadership in Uzbekistan in late 2016. What did President Mirziyoyev say about the media after he came to power, or since he's come to power?
Thank you, Bruce. With regard to President Mirziyoyev's promises, we cannot help but recall the fact that on this Sunday, July 9, Uzbekistan will hold early presidential elections and Mirziyoyev will naturally win with an overwhelming majority. So no surprises are expected. And despite his largely deserved maybe image of the reformer, hardly anyone was shocked that President Mirziyoyev has no intention of going anywhere at the end of his term. And we have seen it all before, and I would like to remind that both the past and the new recently adopted constitution of Uzbekistan provide for only two consecutive presidential terms for one person. So for the past month of presidential campaign, so President Mirziyoyev, he was also campaigning, he has reiterated his commitment to human rights and freedom of media in several speeches. On June 12, he said, "No one can argue with the fact that we have realized very great work to meet the needs of every person, to elevate human dignity to the level of great politics." A week later, in his address to mark Uzbek Media Workers' Day, he said that the media are a bright guide and a mirror of reforms, and that Uzbek leaders must now think about what the media and bloggers have to say before making decisions. So previously, President Mirziyoyev had stated his commitment to protecting and supporting journalists, saying that although others, presumably close to him, had suggested that he should close the media and bring back censorship, he would never do that. And this follows even earlier statements in which he told journalists not to be afraid because he stands behind them. However, these and many other statements by Mirziyoyev about his commitment to respect human rights and freedom of speech are highly contentious, given the rising numbers of bloggers and activists who risked exercising freedom of speech and expression only to find themselves in jail or subjected to heavy fines and intimidation. And as we pointed in the report, in such an environment, President Mirziyoyev's calls to criticize the authorities and calls to the bloggers and journalists not to be afraid because the president is behind them appear at the very least irresponsible, given the absence of protection that put those who believed in him at risk. I can continue. I recently spoke to a blogger who said that in some respects it's even harder to work now than in past because during Karimov regime the lines were clear, there was simply no freedom of speech and you would be punished for any criticism of the authorities. And now local journalists and bloggers, they're kind of navigating a minefield and have to try to avoid kind of risky topics and defined the boundaries of what is permitted themselves. And this, of course, leads to self-censorship. Certainly, the main achievement of the new Uzbekistan is the expansion of the scope of freedom of speech and expression and the ability to disseminate information and exchange opinion on the internet, which so far has remained largely free. But this kind of genie of freedom can be forced back into bottle if warring trends to restrict the activist and journalist and reporting of critical bloggers and journalists continue.
Okay, thank you. Matthew, let me bring you in here. You know, as Amita mentioned, when Mirziyoyev came to power, of course, he said that, you know, you guys can, you have an obligation actually to report and uncover the shortcomings in society and government so that we can correct these kind of things. But and to be fair, and, you know, to everybody, Gazeta.uz and Kun.uz, for example, but there's others, did seem to take him at his word and try to do this. Can you talk about some of the boundaries that journalists have or bloggers have encountered where all of a sudden, you know, there's these undefined boundaries, borders that you can't cross, but people have run into them since Mirziyoyev's statements. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Thank you, Bruce. Thanks for having me on. You know, first I want to say that, you know, the Uzbek Forum's report is excellent. We unfortunately didn't participate in it, just a small clarification, but it's a great report and we really appreciate the work they've done for this. You know, I really like the phrase from the report that there was has been an improvement in the media landscape, but not in media freedom in Uzbekistan. And Umida and you had just noted some improvements since President Mirziyoyev has come to power. And certainly the number of media outlets has expanded. There's more bloggers who are, you know, doing their thing, expressing themselves online. And social media has really blown up and become quite popular. But censorship is alive and well, and self-censorship is alive and well. And while the sort of the bounds of what is allowable to say may not be in law, or they may not be sort of as widely as understood as they once were in the country, they're still being enforced, but perhaps by a different actor. So, for example, with the recent constitutional amendments that were passed a few months ago, you know, I spoke with several people who said that they were asked to come on the media and share their opinion about the constitutional reform only if their opinion was in support of the constitutional reform. And, you know, in addition to that, you know, we understand that the incident with RFERL specifically and reporting on corruption is also sort of an indication of where some of the new lines are. Certainly, the reporting on the residence that was reported to have been used by the president, and all of the everything that happened after that, you know, I think is a pretty clear indication of that. But you know, in addition to that, there's a variety of other issues that where censorship and self-censorship is coming into play in Uzbekistan these days. Certainly, all the different cases that were highlighted in the report. You know, among them, corruption being one of them. And it's not always corruption at the highest levels, you know, that I was just discussing, but corruption at the lowest level. So, for example, Atabek Satori, the blogger who's also covered in this report, was talking about very local level corruption and corruption in the marketplace, which, you know, while quite small scale is really something that will touches the whole population. Everyone goes to the market. And so that's another area where there continues to be, you know, lines that might be clear sometimes and not always clear. You know, and one other thing I would want to mention is that, you know, in addition to the existing laws that are used to persecute people for their expression, we see proposals to strengthen some of those, and we can talk more about it later. But the information code proposal hints at the potential for the introduction of more concrete barriers or limitations, in particular, insulting or showing disrespect to the state or the president as being something that's not acceptable. And then, you know, one other area is promoting same-sex relations. So, you know, certainly LGBT community and expression ideas related to that is another no-go zone. but there's also many others.
Oh, thank you. And Matthew, let me follow up with that. You know, that you said after the report on the executive estate outside of Tashkent and everything, they actually like fine tuned the law, right, about this, so that they're using this all the time now, correct?
Yes. So in the Uzbek forums report, I mean, the law insulting the president was introduced, I believe, in 2021, and you know, this is really problematic from the human rights perspective. It flies completely in the face of Uzbekistan's international obligations in this area, and yeah, really carves out protections for one person in the country to, you know, prevent criticism of this person. When in reality, I mean, this person, you know, people who are running for positions, people who are policymakers, people who are, you know, otherwise putting themselves out there, these are public figures, and the public's need to discuss them, to discuss their positions, their policies, is even more important than it is of private figures. And so actually, the protections for free speech when it comes to talking about these people, their actions, what you think about them, should be even higher than it would for, you know, normal private speech and private actors.
Thank you. Umida, you know, Matthew mentioned that, you know, corruption is one of those unmarked lines that you got to watch out for when you're reporting. But it's even kind of murkier than that in some ways, right? I mean, the media has reported on some officials who are corrupt or abusive in their positions, and they have been fired. And yet there's these other officials that seem to be untouchable. So it's very, isn't it kind of unclear to journalists and bloggers, you know, understanding that the president himself has called for the media to report on corruption so they can root it out, but there seems to be some people they can report on and some people they can't. Is this true?
Yes, that's true. I wanted to mention also that in December 2020, the administrative court was implemented with the Article 202. It's a dissemination of false information, which leads to humiliation of dignity or discrediting person in the media or internet. And also this article, the crime of disseminating false information in the media or online, was added to the criminal court in also in December 2022. And so as Matthew noted, in 2021, new amendments were introduced, including a new criminal provisions for public calls to mass disturbances and violence against citizens. So this gives the authorities a broader mandate to clamp down on freedom of expression. And amendments included public insult or defamation against the president online as a criminal offense, carrying a penalty of up to 5 years imprisonment. And so when we studied the court verdict, so we noticed the kind of disaster state of the judicial system, which is obviously ready to pass judgment on the basis of false or sometimes completely absurd or even fabricated arguments. For example, our report described an administrative case against a blogger for disseminating information that might harm a citizen. And in this case, a blogger wrote a short text in a Facebook group about the death of a child in a kindergarten. So he wrote, "A six-year-old girl died in a kindergarten in Jizak, and we are waiting for explanation from the district administration." So in this text, there was no name of the child. There was no name of the kindergarten. There was no information that would show who he was talking about. So nevertheless, the two courts ruled that the blogger disseminated information that could somehow harm a citizen. And only the Supreme Court overturned the decision. But it cost the blogger money to pay for the lawyer and more than a year in court. So as I said, so in the last couple of years, laws have been passed that limit freedom of speech, such as insulting the president. And also, as Matthew said, there are two cases in the report that illustrate the use of this article. So in one case, a blogger from Khwarezm in a kind of, he was drunk. He used offensive language about President Mirziyoyev and sent an audio tape of it to a group of 20 people. Some time later, he deleted this audio file, but this was enough to sentence the blogger to a penal colony for 3 years. So in another case, an activist from Jizak, Valijon Kalonov, he was sent to a psychiatric clinic for compulsory treatment after he was accused of insulting the president on internet. So he's been there for over a year, and it's not clear when he will be released. And I also wanted to, so the case which was not edited in our report, but it was remarkable. It was a case, the Anor Bank, the bank filed complaint to the court about, So in April this year, so commercial bank, Anor Bank, sued a small website that produced a half a hour YouTube video program. And journalists from this website had interviewed two of the bank's clients who complained that the bank was too slow in transferring funds. And the basis of the bank's claim against the website was that the journalist who published the interview didn't ask the bank for a comment or explanation. And that if they had, the bank would have explained that it had acted according to the rules. So according to the bank, the clients were wanted to conduct the financial transactions from Cyprus, which requires additional verification. But so the clients were real. The stories were real. Maybe the video program was one-sided, but it was not false. And the court ruled that the founder of the website must pay $3 million to the bank for reputational damage. And, of course, this led to the kind of dissolution of the website as the company is now bankrupt. So, and these kind of cases, of course, they give the clear signal there is a certain like officials or certain corporations you cannot criticize. And yeah, I can stop for now. I think I talked a lot.
No, thank you. And we're going to talk more about the individual bloggers here in just a second, but I want to keep with the media for the mainstream or the media outlets for just a minute too. There are subjects. I mentioned corruption is one. Some officials are off limits, and you mentioned that officials and institutions are off limits, whereas others seem to be fair game and kind of in keeping with Mirziyoyev's, you know, appeals to the media to report on corruption. But there's other topics that come up that have gotten media outlets in trouble before. One is the power energy shortages, electricity and heating shortages in the winter, where they've tried to report on it. And of course, everyone sees that there's a problem. But some of these media outlets have been warned, I believe, about what they report. And of course, the other one is Karakol Pakistan. And we just saw that Gazeta.uz put out an article on the one-year anniversary of Karakol Pakistan, which was taken down shortly after that. Matthew, can you speak a little bit about that?
Sure, Bruce. As Amita was just saying, it's criticism of the authorities in general is quite sensitive, and while there is space for that, certainly when it comes to issues that there's a point where it is above what's allowable and in what the security services and others will not respond to, at least in a legal or show of force way. And perhaps the media could, through the cases, talk about some of the specific issues that have been raised. Certainly gas prices have been a very popular topic in the country, not only in Uzbekistan, but across the world. And when there was the energy shortages and the gas prices were also quite high, people were talking about it, and the sensitivity of the issue led the authorities to prevent these folks from publicly expressing themselves or otherwise freely expressing their opinions that are critical of the authorities. And so, it's we've been talking a lot about Mirziyoyev and the president. But also when it comes down to it, many of the actions which contribute to censorship, the actions which respond to people expressing themselves or criticizing the authorities are done at the local level. And so it's not, we're not necessarily talking about a nationwide policy. We're talking about local level leaders who are responding to the specifics of their region and the specifics of the people that are there. And so while, many things are the same across the country, I think that there's also some differences in how this is playing out when it also comes to the specific topics that are more sensitive than others. Now, Karl Pakstan naturally rose to a national importance. Certainly it relates specifically to Karl Pakstan and its place within Uzbekistan and the rights of the people who live there. But when the authorities, perceive that it otherwise threatened governance of the country or their own control or rule, then we also see that the national authorities responded. So there was, as far as I understand it, the introduction of the National Guard, in addition to the actions of the local police who responded to that. And I'm talking about specifically the protests. But then, throughout the process, throughout the court process, we see that the government was, at first trying to be, or apparently trying to be open, maybe that they had perhaps learned some lessons from Kazakhstan and how not only Kazakhstan had responded to the January events, but also how Kazakhstan had responded to the international concern and criticism of its actions in that respect. So, for example, the Uzbek ambassador to the U.S. did a tour of meetings with human rights organizations, ours included, to talk about how, this was going to be investigated and so on and so forth. But, this is not a podcast about Karl Pakstan, but there's been very uneven transparency about what happened, about the government's response. So, for example, with the court process, they had said, we're going to make this open. It is going to be live stream. This is new for Uzbekistan. See, we're being transparent. But what we see is that transparency has been actually really uneven. And we suspect that it's related to these sensitivities that I mentioned before. And, this article that came out that was then immediately withdrawn also is related to those sensitivities. It's exciting in a certain sense that media outlets are, seeing that this is an issue that they want to be looking into, that they want to be reporting, they want to be sharing it with the public, helping them understand what happened and what has happened since then. But certainly a bit major disappointment that they weren't able to do that and that they weren't able to help Uzbekistan really move on from what happened in Karakol, Pakistan, but also pursue accountability for what happened in Karakol, Pakistan.
Okay, thank you. Umida, I'd like to get your impression. I mean, Karakol, Pakistan was the biggest violence in Uzbekistan since Andijan in 2005. Clearly a huge story in Uzbekistan. What do you think about the coverage of that so far?
That's right. This is taboo. And a few days ago, there was anniversary of this Karakol, Pakistan event. And I noticed that there was no a single article in the major media like Kunus or other websites about this event. And I think that it is very clear. It shows that it was probably instruction to the media sent that don't write anything. And we have this case of Gazeta Us when the article about Karakol, Pakistan was just moved from their website. And I recently spoke with the journalist Anora Sadekova. She was one of the initiators of the letter to the president. I think it was in March this year, but the open letter signed by more than 40 journalists and bloggers about the strict but invisible censorship. And she said that it's ironically, so this reports of threats against bloggers and journalists intensified just before the referendum on the new constitution, which has been kind of shown as like strengthening the rights and freedoms of Uzbek citizens. And Anora said that also there was a kind of instructions to the journalists and bloggers, not like better not to write anything about referendum. Don't ask questions. So this event should just kind of go smoothly. Yeah, there are topics of taboo. Presidential family is untouchable. Of course, in the media, there is no any serious discussion about the absence of political opposition in the country, or they are organizing so-called political debate in the media, on the TV between the candidates for the presidency, but President Mirziyoyev himself is not attending. Of course, there are many questions also to him, to his policy. So these kind of questions are not allowed. But at the same time, we see that it's also very risky to criticize the local officials. And the case of Otabek Satari, the blogger who was one of the critics of the local Hakim of Surkhandarya region, it shows that it's how quickly the state can just silence the blogger.
Okay, thank you. And a reminder, my guests are Matthew Schaff, a rights advocate and advocacy director at the Washington-based organization Freedom Now, and Umida Niyazova, director at the Germany-based Uzbek Forum for Human Rights. And we're talking about the recent report from the Uzbek Forum for Human Rights entitled President's Broken Promises Puts Journalists and Bloggers at Risk. And let's talk specifically about some of these bloggers now for the second half of the program. And Umida, I'll start with you. But, you know, the one that I want to talk about first is Valijan Kolonov, because he was actually sentenced to a psychiatric hospital. And that sounds a lot like the old Uzbekistan of Islam Karimov and not the new Uzbekistan of Shavkat Mirziyoyev.
That's right. The case of Valijan Kolonov is very remarkable, and also because this is the first case when the police used after the amendments of the law about criticizing the president online. So he was sent to psychiatric clinic for compulsory treatment, and he's been there for over a year, and it's not clear when he will be released. And it is true that he did make an offensive remark about the president on one YouTube video, comparing the president and his entourage to rats. It may have been offensive, but like as Matthew also was telling, in this case, there's a question of proportionality of punishment. And also we know that officials and public figures appear to be more easily offended than most of us. And I also wanted to mention the case of Olemjon Haydarov, because he tried to report about gas shortage, and this is also there was a taboo topic. And in December last year, he went to interview the factory workers who complained that the factory is not working because of the shortage of the gas, and they're not receiving salaries. And for interviewing these workers and posting the videos online, he was accused of violation of the order of organizing or holding meetings, rallies, or demonstrations. Like simply the blogger who went to interview the real people with the real problems, he posted the video online, and somehow he was found by the court of organizing this, organizing some demonstration.
Okay, thank you. And Matthew, of course, you're free to talk, both of you, you can talk about either of these cases, but I'm just going to ask, each of you specifically to comment on one case, although, again, feel free to comment on any of the cases that I mentioned. Matthew, you mentioned at the start Atabek Sattari, right? And his case, he was reporting on corruption. Can you kind of walk us through what happened to him, what he was reporting on, and what happened to him in the end?
Sure. Just to briefly on Kalonev and his situation, one aspect that we see in this case, and we see in many other cases, is the use of expert witnesses and expertise. And this is a big problem in Uzbekistan. Certainly, you know, court processes all the time include expert opinions analyzing one thing or another. But what we see in Uzbekistan is that defendants basically have no opportunity to present their own expertise. And so essentially, there's state-appointed experts who provide generally state-approved expert opinions that then lead to these convictions. You know, in the case of Kalonov, there was an expert who said that he exhibited mental illness, and that was the basis through which he was committed. And this happens across many of these different cases. Now, with Atabek, so my organization, Freedom Now, did provide legal assistance to him in the international appeal to the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. And so, you know, Atabek is a blogger and has reported on a variety of issues of local interest, but certainly corruption and concerns about corruption in local business and local authorities. And during the pandemic, at a time when there were price controls in the country, because you know, the authorities were rightfully concerned about high prices and inflation, he went to the market to go and see if the market sellers were actually complying with these price controls. And there ended up being a conflict, and his phone was in that conflict was somehow damaged and was also taken from him. And so he had spoken with the market director, asking for his phone back, which he got, but it was broken. And so he had asked the market director to replace the phone. And it was at the point where the officials from the market gave him the new phone. So, you know, they agreed to replace his phone that was damaged in the scuffle. Immediately after that, he was arrested by the authorities. And so he was arrested and tried on a variety of administrative violations. And then there were additional charges against him, criminal violations related to his reporting. And so they had alleged, for example, that he had extorted the phone from the local market. There were also accusations that he had slandered various officials. And in the end, was convicted and sentenced to, I believe it was 6 years in prison. Now, one thing I think that's interesting about Sattari's case is that really the authorities didn't even try to defend their actions in a serious way. There was, you know, the accusation made under very vague laws. There was a court process that was really problematic. And so they never really had to seriously make the case of why, you know, Atabek's imprisonment was necessary, you know, why he had violated the law. And in the opinion from the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, so this is this UN body that hears cases and then, you know, makes determinations about whether they think someone is being detained in violation of their rights and their detention is arbitrary. They noted, for example, signs that really the whole case was fabricated against him, that, you know, all the you know, supposed witnesses, for example, had appealed to the authorities at the exact same time. So there were some suspicious facts of the case, and they indicated that there was indications that it was done in a deliberately planned manner. So in the end, they found that there was basically no legal basis for his detention, that he was in fact persecuted for exercising his rights, and that he was being discriminated against because of his critical position with respect to the authorities. And so, I mean, this is, we have, you know, his case has been reviewed by a variety of different institutions. And, you know, we have this this ruling from the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, which has called for his being freed from prison, for all the charges to be withdrawn, and for him to be rehabilitated in the country, which involves a variety of different things, but certainly getting out of jail and having the charges withdrawn and the conviction withdrawn would be a part of that process.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it goes without saying that the authorities have not done that. He remains in detention as far as we understand that. And there continue to be concerns about his treatment in detention as well.
Thank you.
I just want to add, regarding Sattari, just quickly, that in May last year, a member of human rights organization, Izgulik, he was able to meet Sattari in prison. And so Otabek said that he had believed in president's words and became a blogger, but ended up a victim of corruption.
Let me ask too, I seem to remember that very recently, one of the officials that Sattari had named and alleged was involved in corruption is now under investigation for corruption. Isn't this true?
Absolutely, yes. So the Hakim, the city mayor of Termez, who testified in court that Sattari engaged in extortion, he himself was arrested in October last year and charged with a number of serious crimes, so including corruption, embezzlement. And so despite this, the Supreme Court upheld Sattari's sentence.
Okay, thank you. Amazing, simply amazing. I want to mention the case of Fazihui Arif Hojaev. Can you tell us a little bit about him? He's a little bit different than the other bloggers.
Yes, this is also a very remarkable case, actually. The Arif Hojaev, he's considering to be a religious blogger. He's a religious man. He was sentenced in January last year to 7.5 years in prison for one post on Facebook page in which he disputed whether Muslims should celebrate Christian holidays. And this alone was considered by court to qualify as extremist religious views. And frankly, so I read the case of Arif Hojaev and the court verdict, there is nothing more. The short post about this celebration of Christian holidays was enough for the Uzbek court to send this man to 7.5 years in prison.
Okay, we're running close to the end, but Mati, I want to ask you about the case of Miraziz Bazarov. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. Miraziz is an outspoken blogger. He has, shared his opinion and reported on a variety of different issues, certainly corruption, the actions of the authorities. One thing that sets him apart is that he also, shared his opinion about LGBT rights, and in particular in a more supportive way than is common in Uzbekistan for people to share publicly. And for that, he was brutally beaten and is under house arrest. I believe he also was sentenced to house arrest for three and a half years for this. Certainly his case had received a good deal of international attention. Part of that being that there were some strange features. So, for example, he apparently was involved in some kind of gathering of K-pop and anime fans. And then on the same day, but later in the day, he was in fact assaulted quite seriously injured, and injuries that he continues to deal with, as far as I understand it. Right now there he's under house arrest. He is quite limited in what he can do. So, for example, he's I believe a psychologist, but he's prohibited by the court from working as a psychologist. He's also prohibited from using the internet and from doing other basic things during his house arrest. And this is all for expressing himself on the internet. Now, it's interesting. Miraziz had spoken about LGBT issues, and there's another blogger who was also connected to the previous case that we just spoke about with Arif Hojaev. And this was actually the blogger who was on the other side of this conflict. And that's Abur Mukhtar Ali, who is also a religious blogger, but you know, for some reason hasn't had a problem with the authorities, despite really being a flamethrower with the kinds of issues that he raises and the kinds of things that he says online, certainly about LGBT community, but not only. Now, you know, perhaps one difference is that Abur Mukhtar Ali is actually a government employee and is affiliated with the state religious authorities. But clearly, you know, there's different rules for different people. It appears that, you know, relationship from with the state might help, but certainly also the issues are quite important. Yeah, I'll stop there for now.
Okay, great. Thank you. Time for the last question, although feel free to mention any comments you want that you think some topic we haven't addressed. But my last question is there any difference between the media in Karimov's time and the media in Mirziyoyev's time? And I'll start with you, Matthew.
Certainly. Certainly there is. There's more media. There appears to be more space. But we're seeing that change. You know, over the last few years, it seems like the space that opened up in President Mirziyoyev's first few years of governance is closing. And I think the cases that are documented in the Uzbek Forum for Human Rights report are quite indicative of this. These people have been targeted for what they're saying, for what they've peacefully expressed. And, you know, there's been a variety of other incidents that we've spoken about today and others that we haven't that I think are also indicative of this closing space. Now, I mean, this runs completely against what the Uzbek authorities are telling their international partners. So, for example, there was an Uzbekistan Day on Capitol Hill recently, where Senator Sadiq Safoyev, the first thing he said was, Uzbekistan is prioritizing human rights. Now, I think this report is quite indicative of the fact that that's not the case. But I sincerely hope that the authorities do take these obligations more seriously, their international obligations and their domestic obligations, and begin really tackling some of these challenging problems and prioritizing human rights like they say they have.
Okay, great. Thank you. Umida, give the last word to you. And as someone who's been the target of the Uzbek authorities in the past, is there any difference you see? What are the differences between Karimov's old Uzbekistan and Mirziyoyev's new Uzbekistan?
Yes, there is a difference, of course. I've been arrested and also sentenced to jail for having Human Rights Watch report in my files, in my notebook, which was confiscated. And still compare with Karimov's time, we can say that there is more freedom, especially on the internet. But at the same time, there is the internet and social media was not so developed at that time as it is used now. But Karimov era, Karimov time, was not also the same. This is not the first time Uzbekistan has experienced the kind of thaw. And in the earlier 2000s, dozens of offices of major international media, for instance, Ozodlik had an office in Tashkent, and international organizations, Freedom House, Human Rights Watch, they were also registered in Uzbekistan. But following the Andijan massacre in 2005, this kind of period ended. So that's why this recent trend is very alarming. So we can say that compared to this brutal, most repressive period of Karimov's time, it is better now, but we really don't know what will be in the future.
Okay, thank you very much. And we have run out of time. But just a reminder to our audience that you can read this report, President's Broken Promises Puts Journalists and Bloggers at Risk, at uzbekforum.org. Thank you very much, Umida. And thank you very much, Matthew, for being on the program. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asian Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.